History's Book 5, Terpsichore. The Persians left behind in Europe by Darius, whom Megabazus commanded, first subdued the Perinthians of the Hellespont, who were unwilling to be subjects of Darius, though they had earlier been roughly handled by the Paeonians as well. For the Paeonians from the Strymon, on the gods' instruction to campaign against the Perinthians, were told that if the Perinthians, encamped opposite them, should call out to them by name and challenge them, they were to attack. But if they were not called out to, they were not to attack. The Paeonians did just this. When the Perinthians had encamped opposite them in the suburb, a threefold single combat arose there by challenge. Man was matched against man, horse against horse, and dog against dog. The Perinthians won two of the three, and as they raised the paean in their joy, the Paeonians reckoned that this very thing was the fulfillment of the oracle, and said among themselves, "Now surely the oracle is being fulfilled for us. Now it is our work." So while the Perinthians were singing their paean, the Paeonians attacked them and prevailed decisively, leaving few of them alive. That is how the earlier affair with the Paeonians came about. But now, when the Perinthians proved brave men in the cause of their freedom, the Persians and Megabazus prevailed by sheer numbers. When Perinthus had been subdued, Megabazus marched his army through Thrace, bringing under the king's sway every city and every people settled in that region. For this had been enjoined upon him by Darius to subdue Thrace. The Thracian people is the greatest of all mankind, after the Indians at least, and if it were ruled by one man, or were of one mind, it would be invincible and by far the mightiest of all peoples, in my judgment. But since this is impossible for them and can never come about, they are for that reason weak. They have many names, each group according to its own region, but they all follow customs very much alike in every respect, except the Getae, the Trossi, and those settled above the Crestinians. Of these, what the Getae do, who claim to be immortal, has already been told by me. The Trossi carry out all their other customs just as the rest of the Thracians do, but as regards one who is born and one who dies among them, they do this. When a child is born, the relatives sit around it and lament, reckoning up all the sufferings it must endure now that it has come into being, rehearsing every human woe. But when a man dies, they bury him in the earth with playfulness and rejoicing, saying that he is now rid of so many evils and is in complete happiness. Those settled above the Crestinians do the following. Each man has many wives, and whenever one of them dies, a great contest arises among the wives, with keen efforts on the part of their friends, over which of them was most loved by the husband. And whichever is judged and honored, praised by both men and women, is slaughtered over the grave by her nearest kinsmen, and having been slaughtered is buried together with her husband. The other wives count this a great misfortune, for it is reckoned the greatest disgrace to them. Among the rest of the Thracians, the custom is this: they sell their children to be taken abroad. They do not guard their unmarried daughters, but let them have intercourse with whatever men they wish. Their wives, however, they guard strictly, and they buy their wives from the parents for great sums of money. To be tattooed is reckoned a mark of noble birth, and to be without tattoos a mark of low birth. To be idle is considered most honorable, and to work the land most dishonorable. To live by war and plunder is considered most honorable of all. These are their most notable customs. They worship only the following gods: Ares, Dionysus, and Artemis. But their kings, apart from the rest of the citizens, worship Hermes above all the gods and swear only by him, and say that they themselves are descended from Hermes. The burial customs for their wealthy men are these. They lay out the corpse for 3 days, and after slaughtering all sorts of victims, they feast, having first mourned. Then they bury the body, either burning it or otherwise hiding it in the earth, and after heaping up a mound, they hold games of every kind, in which the greatest prizes are set for single combat, as is fitting. Such then are the burial customs of the Thracians. As for the region north of this country, no one can say for certain what people inhabit it, but already beyond the Ister, the land appears to be empty and boundless. The only people I can learn of dwelling beyond the Ister are those called Sigini, who wear Median dress. Their horses are said to be shaggy over their whole body to a depth of 5 fingers' breadth of hair, small, snub-nosed, and unable to carry men. But when yoked to chariots, they are extremely swift. And it is for this reason that the local people drive chariots. Their borders reach close to the Enetoi, who live on the Adriatic. They say they are colonists of the Medes. How they came to be colonists of the Medes I myself cannot explain, but anything might happen in the long course of time. In any case, the people whom the Ligurians who live inland above Massalia call Sigini are what the Cyprians call peddlers, and spears are called Sigini by the Cyprians. As the Thracians tell it, bees occupy the land beyond the Ister, and because of them, it is impossible to travel further in that direction. To me, however, those who say this seem to be saying something implausible, for those creatures are evidently unable to endure cold. Rather, it seems to me that the regions under the bear are uninhabited because of the cold. This, then, is what is said about this country, but Megabazus made the coastal parts of it subject to the Persians. As for Darius, as soon as he had crossed the Hellespont and arrived at Sardis, he remembered the good service done him by Hystieus of Miletus and the advice of Cos of Mytilene, and summoning them to Sardis, he offered each of them his choice of a reward. Hystieus, since he was already tyrant of Miletus, did not ask for any tyranny at all, but asked for Myasinus in the land of the Edonians, wishing to found a city there. This, then, is what he chose. But Cos, since he was not a tyrant but a private citizen, asked to become tyrant of Mytilene. When both requests had been granted, each of them went off to pursue what he had chosen. But Darius, as it happened, came to see something that made him desire to instruct Megabazus to capture the Paeonians and forcibly remove them from Europe to Asia. There were two Paeonian men, Pigers and Mantes, who, once Darius had crossed over into Asia, being themselves eager to become tyrants of the Paeonians, came to Sardis, bringing with them their sister, who was tall and beautiful. Having watched for a time when Darius was seated in state in the suburb of the Lydians, they did the following. Having adorned their sister as well as they could, they sent her for water, carrying a jar on her head, leading a horse by its bridle from her arm, and spinning flax as she went. When the woman passed by, it caught Darius's attention, for what the woman was doing was neither Persian nor Lydian custom, nor anything like the customs of the peoples of Asia at all. Since it had caught his attention, he dispatched some of his spearmen with orders to observe how the woman would deal with the horse. So they followed along behind her, and when she reached the river, she watered the horse, and having watered it and filled the jar with water, she passed back along the same road, carrying the water on her head, leading the horse by the bridle from her arm, and turning her spindle. Darius, marveling both at what he heard from his scouts and at what he saw himself, ordered her to be brought before him. When she was brought, her brothers were also present, having been watching from not far off. When Darius asked her what country she was from, the young men said that they were Paeonians, and that she was their sister. He answered by asking who the Paeonians were as a people, and where in the world they lived, and what they wanted in coming to Sardis. Their reply was that they had come intending to hand themselves over to him, and that Paeonia was a land settled on the river Strymon, the Strymon not far from the Hellespont, and that they were colonists of the Teucrians from Troy. This is what they told him, each point in turn, and he asked whether all the women there were such hard workers. They said that this was indeed eagerly so, for it was for this very reason that she had been made to do it. At this Darius wrote a letter to Megabazus, whom he had left as general in Thrace, instructing him to uproot the Paeonians from their homes and bring them to him, both the people themselves and their children and wives. At once a horseman ran off carrying the message to the Hellespont, and having crossed over gave the letter to Megabazus. He, having read it and taking guides from Thrace, marched against Paeonia. When the Paeonians learned that the Persians were coming against them, they gathered together and marched out toward the sea, expecting that the Persians would attempt to invade by that route. The Paeonians, then, were ready to check Megabazus's advancing army. But the Persians, learning that the Paeonians had assembled and were guarding the approach from the sea, took guides and turned onto the inland road instead, and without the Paeonians' knowledge fell upon their cities, which were empty of men, and falling upon them while empty they took them easily. When the Paeonians learned that their cities were held, they at once scattered, each man going his own way, and gave themselves up to the Persians. Thus of the Paeonians, the Syriopaeonians and the Pieplei, and those as far as Lake Prages, were uprooted from their homes and led away into Asia. But those around Mount Pangaeum and Dobers, and the Agrians, and the Odomanti, and Lake Prages itself were not at first subdued by Megabazus. He did, however, attempt to remove those settled on the lake in the following manner. Platforms fastened upon tall piles stand in the middle of the lake, with a single narrow approach from the mainland by one bridge. The piles that support the platforms were originally set up jointly by all the citizens in common, but afterward they follow this custom in setting up their dwellings. Bringing timber down from the mountain called Orbilos, each man who marries sets up 3 stakes for each wife he takes, and each man takes many wives. They live in this fashion. Each holds his own hut on the platforms, where he lives, and there is a trapdoor through the platform leading down to the lake. They tie the little children by the foot with a cord, fearing that they might roll down into the water. To their horses and pack animals, they give fish as fodder, and fish are so abundant that when a man opens the trapdoor and lets down an empty basket on a rope into the lake, after waiting only a short time, he draws it up full of fish. There are 2 kinds of these fish, which they call P-A-P-R, Achaia and Tylon. As for the Paeonians, those who had been subdued were led away to Asia. Once Megabazus had subdued the Paeonians, he sent messengers to Macedonia, 7 Persians ranking, after himself, as the most eminent men in the army. These were sent to Amyntas to demand earth and water for King Darius. There is a very direct route from Lake Prages to Macedonia. First there lies, next to the lake, the mine from which, later on, a talent of silver came in to Alexander every day. And beyond the mine, once one has crossed the mountain called Dicearon, one is in Macedonia. So when these Persians who had been sent arrived at Amyntas's court, they came into his presence and asked for earth and water on behalf of King Darius. And he gave these and invited them to be his guests, and having prepared a magnificent dinner, he received the Persians hospitably. When the meal was over, as they sat drinking, the Persians said this: "Macedonian host, it is our custom among the Persians, whenever we set out a great feast, then to bring in our concubines and wedded wives as well to sit beside us. You then, since you have received us so eagerly and entertain us so lavishly, and since you give earth and water to King Darius, follow our custom." Amyntas answered them thus: "Persians, that is not our custom here. Among us men and women are kept apart. But since you, as our masters, request this, it shall be granted to you as well." Having said this much, Amyntas sent for the women, and when they came at his summons, they sat down in a row facing the Persians. Then the Persians, seeing the beautiful women, said to Amyntas that what had been done was not wise at all. It would have been better from the start for the women not to come at all than to come and sit opposite them rather than beside them, a torment to their eyes. Amyntas, under compulsion, ordered the women to sit beside them. And when the women obeyed, the Persians at once began fondling their breasts, being rather far gone in wine, and some of them even tried to kiss them. Amyntas, seeing this, held himself still, though he was distressed, for he was in great fear of the Persians. But Alexander, Amyntas's son, who stood by watching all this unfold, being young and untried by hardship, could no longer contain himself, and being sorely aggrieved, said this to Amyntas: "Father, you should yield to your age and go withdraw and rest, and not press yourself further with the drinking. I will remain here myself and provide everything needful for our guests." At this Amyntas, understanding that Alexander intended to do something rash, said, "My son, I understand from your heated words, since you are on fire, that you wish to send me away so as to do something rash. I ask you, then, not to act rashly against these men, so that you do not ruin us, but bear with watching what is being done. As for my own departure, I will follow your advice on that." When Amyntas, having asked this, had gone away, Alexander said to the Persians, "Guests, as regards these women, you have full freedom to lie with all of them, or with as many of them as you wish. On this matter, you yourselves may declare your pleasure. But now, since the hour of retiring to bed is already approaching for you, and I see you are in a fine state from your drinking, allow these women, if it is agreeable to you, to go and bathe, and after bathing receive them back again." Having said this, for the Persians agreed, he sent the women out to the women's quarters, and Alexander himself dressed an equal number of beardless young men in the women's clothing, and giving them daggers led them in, bringing them before the Persians and saying this: "Persians, it seems you have been feasted with a complete banquet. For everything else we had, and whatever else we could find and provide, all this is at your disposal. And above all this, the greatest thing of all, we lavish upon you our own mothers and sisters, so that you may fully learn that you are honored by us as much as you deserve, and further that you may tell the king who sent you here how a Greek man, governor of the Macedonians, received you well both at table and in bed. Having said this, Alexander seated a Macedonian man beside each Persian man in the guise, in word, of a woman, and these men, when the Persians tried to touch them, killed them. And so they perished by this fate, they and their attendants as well. For there had followed them their carriages and servants and all their great equipage, all this together with all of them vanished. Not long afterward a great search for these men was mounted by the Persians, and Alexander suppressed it by cunning, giving much money and his own sister, whose name was Gygaea. Giving these, Alexander bought off Buberes, a Persian man, one of those searching for the lost men, on behalf of the general. Thus the death of these Persians was covered up and passed over in silence. That these men, the descendants of Perdiccas, are Greek, as they themselves say, I myself happen to know to be so, and I will indeed demonstrate in the following account that they are Greeks. And further, the Hellenotici who administer the contest at Olympia have also judged it to be so. For when Alexander chose to compete and came down for that very purpose, his prospective Greek rivals in the footrace sought to bar him, claiming the contest was open to Greeks only and not open to barbarians. But Alexander, when he proved that he was an Argive, was judged to be Greek, and competing in the Stadian race he tied for first place. Such, then, is how that came about. Megabazus, leading the Paeonians, arrived at the Hellespont. From there, having crossed over, he arrived at Sardis. Since Hystiaeus of Miletus was already fortifying the place he had asked of Darius as a reward for guarding the bridge, the place being by the river Strymon, called Miasinus, Megabazus, learning what Hystiaeus was doing, as soon as he arrived at Sardis leading the Paeonians, said this to Darius. O king, what a thing you have done in allowing a clever and capable Greek man to found a city in Thrace, where there is abundant timber for shipbuilding and many ores and silver mines, and where a great crowd, both Greek and non-Greek, dwells around, who, once they get a leader, will do whatever he directs day and night. You, then, must stop this man from doing these things, lest you become embroiled in a war at home. Stop him by summoning him in some gentle manner. And once you have got hold of him, see to it that he never returns to the Greeks again. By saying this, Megabazus easily persuaded Darius, since it seemed he foresaw well what was going to happen. Then, sending a messenger to Miasinus, Darius said this. Hystiaeus, King Darius says this. As I reflect, I find that there is no man more well disposed to me and to my affairs than you, and this I know not from words but from deeds I have witnessed. Now then, since I am planning to accomplish great undertakings, come to me by all means, so that I may lay these plans before you. Trusting these words, Hystiaeus, and at the same time making it a great thing to become the king's counselor, came to Sardis. And when he arrived, Darius said this to him. Hystiaeus, I summoned you for this reason. From the moment I returned from the Scythians, and you passed out of my sight, I have sought nothing else so urgently in so short a time as to see you, and to come to speech with you, knowing that of all possessions the most precious is a friend who is wise and well-disposed, qualities which I know you possess in both respects, and can attest to regarding my own affairs. Now then, since you have done well in coming, I propose this to you. Leave Miletus and the newly founded city in Thrace, and follow me to Susa, where you shall have what I have, as my table companion and counselor. Having said this, Darius, after appointing Artaphernes, his own brother by the same father, to be governor of Sardis, drove away to Susa, taking Hystiaeus with him, and having appointed Otanes to be general of the men along the coast. Otanes's father Sisamnes, who had been one of the royal judges, King Cambyses had put to death and flayed entirely, because he had given an unjust judgment for money. And having stripped off his skin, he cut it into strips and stretched them over the seat on which Sisamnes used to sit in judgment. Having stretched it, Cambyses appointed as judge in place of Sisamnes, whom he had killed and flayed, the son of Sisamnes, instructing him to remember, when seated on that seat, what judgments he gave. This Otanes, then, who sat upon that seat, having now become Megabazus's successor in the command, took Byzantium and Chalcedon, and took Antandros in the Troad, and took Lamponian. And having taken ships from the Lesbians, he took Lemnos and Imbros, both of which were still at that time inhabited by Pelasgians. The Lemnians fought well and, defending themselves, were worn down over time. And over the survivors of them, the Persians set as governor Lycurgus, brother of Meandrius, who had been king of Samos. This man, Lycurgus, the governor of Lemnos, died. This was the reason. He had been enslaving and subjugating everyone, accusing some of desertion from the campaign against the Scythians, and others of harming Darius' army as it made its way back from the Scythians. Such were his accomplishments as governor. Not long after, there was a lull in troubles, and then, for the second time, misfortunes began to arise for the Ionians, this time from Naxos and Miletus. Naxos surpassed the other islands in prosperity, and at the same time Miletus itself, then at the very height of its own power, was the pride of Ionia. Yet in the two generations before this, Miletus had been afflicted by civil strife of the worst kind, until the Parians restored order there. For the Milesians chose the Parians, out of all the Greeks, as their arbitrators. The Parians reconciled them in this way. When their best men arrived in Miletus and saw how terribly ruined the estates were, they said they wished to go through the countryside. As they did this, passing through the whole territory of Miletus, whenever they saw a well-cultivated field amid the devastated land, they wrote down the name of the field's owner. After driving through the whole territory and finding only a few such men, as soon as they came down to the city, they called an assembly and declared that these men, whose fields they had found well cultivated, should govern the city. For they said they believed these men would take care of public affairs just as they had cared for their own. As for the rest of the Milesians, who had previously been rioting, they ordered them to obey these men. Thus did the Parians restore order to Miletus. It was from these cities that troubles now began to come upon Ionia in this way. Certain wealthy men were exiled from Naxos by the common people, and in their flight they came to Miletus. It happened that the guardian of Miletus at that time was Aristagoras son of Malpagoras, who was both son-in-law and cousin of Hishiaeus son of Lysagoras, whom Darius was keeping at Susa. For Hishiaeus was tyrant of Miletus, and he happened to be in Susa at that time, when the Naxians, who had previously been guest friends of Hishiaeus, arrived. Coming to Miletus, the Naxians asked Aristagoras whether he might somehow supply them with a force so that they could return to their own land. He, reasoning that if they returned to their city through his agency, he would rule Naxos, put forward as his pretext his guest friendship with Hishiaeus, and made this proposal to them. "I myself am not able to supply you with a force great enough to bring you back against the will of the Naxians who now hold the city, for I hear that the Naxians have 8,000 shields and many long ships. But I will contrive something, using all diligence. Here is my plan. Artafrens happens to be a friend of mine, and Artafrens is son of Hystaspes and brother of King Darius, and he commands all the peoples along the sea in Asia, with a large army and many ships. I think this man will do whatever we ask of him." Hearing this, the Naxians left it to Aristagoras to act as best he could, and told him to promise gifts and provisions for the army, which they themselves would repay, having great hopes that once they appeared before Naxos, the Naxians would do everything they commanded, and likewise the other islanders too. For none of these Cycladic islands was yet under Darius. Arriving at Sardis, Aristagoras told Artafrens that Naxos was an island not great in size, but otherwise fair and good, and near Ionia, and that it had much wealth and many slaves. "So lead an expedition against this land, restoring to it the exiles from it. If you do this, in the first place I have great sums of money ready for you, over and above what will be spent on the army, for it is only right that we who are leading the expedition should provide this, and in the second place you will win for the King Islands, Naxos itself and those that depend on it, Paros, Andros, and the others called the Cyclades. And setting out from there, you will easily attack Euboea, a large and prosperous island, no smaller than Cyprus and very easy to capture. 100 ships would suffice to subdue all of these." Artafrens replied to him thus, "You are proposing an excellent course of action for the house of the king, and all your advice is good, except for the number of ships. Instead of 100 ships, 200 will be ready for you by spring. But the king himself must also give his consent to these plans." When Aristagoras heard this, he was overjoyed and went back to Miletus. Artafrens, once he had sent to Susa and reported what Aristagoras had said, and Darius himself had also given his consent, prepared 200 triremes and a very great host of Persians and other allies, and appointed as their commander Megabates, a Persian of the Achaemenids, cousin to both himself and Darius, whose daughter, if the story is indeed true, Pausanias, son of Cleombrotus, the Lacedaemonian, later married, having conceived a desire to become tyrant of Greece. Having appointed Megabates as commander, Artaphernes sent the army off to Aristagoras. Megabates took Aristagoras from Miletus, along with the Ionian force and the Naxians, and sailed, ostensibly for the Hellespont. But when he reached Chios, he put in with the fleet at Kokassa, so that from there he could cross to Naxos with a north wind. And since it was not fated for the Naxians to be destroyed by this expedition, the following incident occurred. As Megabates was going around inspecting the watches on the ships, it happened that no one was standing guard on a Mindian ship. Enraged at this, he ordered his spearmen to find the commander of this ship, whose name was Sylax, and to bind him by passing him through an oarhole of the ship in such a way that his head was outside and his body inside. When Sylax had been bound in this way, someone reported to Aristagoras that Megabates had tied up his guest friend the Mindian and was mistreating him. Aristagoras went and pleaded with the Persian on his behalf, but got nothing of what he asked for, so he went himself and released the man. When Megabates learned of this, he was greatly angered and grew furious with Aristagoras, who said to him, "What business is this of yours and these matters? Did not Artaphernes send you to obey me and to sail wherever I order? Why do you meddle in so much?" So spoke Aristagoras. Megabates, enraged by this, when night came, sent men by boat to Naxos to tell the Naxians everything that was in store for them. For the Naxians had not at all expected that this expedition was setting out against them. When, however, they learned of it, they immediately brought in their possessions from the fields into the city wall, prepared food and drink as if to withstand a siege, and strengthen the wall. So they made ready as men expecting war to come upon them. And when the enemy had crossed over their ships from Chios to Naxos, they attacked a people already fortified, and besieged them for 4 months. When the money the Persians had brought with them was used up, and Aristagoras himself had spent a great deal in addition, and the siege demanded still more, at that point they built forts for the Naxian exiles and withdrew to the mainland in bad shape. Aristagoras was unable to fulfill his promise to Artaphernes. At the same time, he was pressed by the demand for repayment of the army's expenses, and he was afraid on account of the army's failure and of having been slandered by Megabates, and he thought he would be deprived of the rule of Miletus. Fearing all these things, he began to plot a revolt. For it happened that at the same time the man with the tattooed head arrived from Susa from Hystiaeus, signaling that it was time for Aristagoras to break away from the king's rule. Hystiaeus, wishing to signal to Aristagoras to revolt, had no other safe way of doing so, since the roads were guarded, so he shaved the head of his most trusted slave, tattooed it, and waited for the hair to grow back. As soon as it had grown back, he sent the man to Miletus with no other instructions except that, when he arrived in Miletus, he should tell Aristagoras to shave his hair and examine what was on his scalp. The tattoo marks signaled, as I have said before, revolt. Hystiaeus did this because he considered his detention at Susa a great misfortune, for he cherished strong hopes that, should an uprising break out, he would be sent down to the coast, but that if Miletus made no new move, he reckoned he would never return there again. With this in mind, then, Hystiaeus sent off his messenger, and all these things happened to coincide for Aristagoras at the same time. So he took counsel with his partisans, revealing to them both his own opinion and what had come from Hystiaeus. All the others expressed the same view, urging revolt. But Hecateus, the logographer, first advised against taking up war with the king of the Persians at all, listing all the nations Darius ruled over and his power. When he failed to persuade them, he then advised, as a second course, that they should make themselves masters of the sea. He said he could see no way for this to come about otherwise, for he knew that the power of the Milesians was weak, but that if the treasures were taken down from the temple at Branchidae, which Croesus the Lydian had dedicated, he had great hopes they could gain mastery of the sea, and in this way they themselves would have the use of the money, and the enemy would not plunder it. This treasure was great, as I have shown in the first of my accounts. This proposal did not prevail. Nevertheless, the decision for rebellion was taken, together with a plan that one of their number would voyage to Mayas, where the expedition that had withdrawn from Naxos lay encamped, and their attempt to arrest the generals sailing aboard the ships. Iatragoras having been sent off for this very purpose after Iobate's son had treacherously seized Oleadus of Mylasa, and Hishiaeus son of Timnes had seized Hermon of Termera, and Co's son of Erxander, the man on whom Darius had bestowed Mytilene, along with Aristagoras son of Heraclides of Syme, and many others besides, Aristagoras now revolted openly, contriving everything against Darius. First, he gave up the tyranny in name only and established equal rights under law at Miletus, so that the Milesians would join his revolt willingly. Then he did the same thing in the rest of Ionia, driving out some of the tyrants. And those tyrants he had taken from the ships that had sailed together against Naxos, he handed over to their own cities, wishing to win favor with them, giving each man back to whatever city he came from. As for Kos, the Mytileneans, as soon as they got hold of him, took him out and stoned him to death. The people of Syme, however, let their own man go free, and most of the others released theirs as well. So the removal of the tyrants took place throughout the cities. And when Aristagoras of Miletus had put down the tyrants, he ordered that generals be appointed in each of the cities, and then he himself set out as an envoy by trireme to Laestemon, for he needed to find some great ally. Now at Sparta, Anaxandrides son of Leon was no longer alive to be king, for he had died, and Cleomenes son of Anaxandrides held the kingship, not because of any merit, but by right of birth. Anaxandrides, in fact, had married his own sister's daughter, and though she was dear to him, they had no children. Since this was the state of affairs, the ephors summoned him and said, "If you yourself will not look out for your own interest, we cannot allow this to go unwatched, that the line of Eurysthenes should die out. You now have a wife, but since she bears you no children, divorce her and marry another. If you do this, you will please the Spartans." He answered that he would do neither of these things, and that they were not giving him good advice in urging him to send away the wife he had, who was blameless toward him, and take another in her place. He would not obey them. In response to this, the ephors and the elders took counsel and put the following proposal to Anaxandrides. "Since we see that you cling to the wife you have, then do as we say and do not oppose us, lest the Spartans decide on some other course concerning you. We are not asking you to send away the wife you have. Keep giving her everything you now provide, and in addition to her, bring in another wife who can bear children." Speaking to him in this way, they persuaded him, and afterward he kept two wives and maintained two separate households, doing nothing that was customary for a Spartan. Not much time passed before the wife who had come to him later bore this Cleomenes. And she thereby produced an heir to the kingship for the Spartans, while the earlier wife, who had been childless all that time, then somehow became pregnant, as it happened by coincidence. Now while she was truly pregnant, the relatives of the second wife, on learning of it, made trouble, saying she was boasting falsely and wanted to substitute a child. And since they made such an uproar, and the time was drawing near, the ephors, out of distrust, sat around the woman and watched her give birth. She, once she had borne Dorius, immediately conceived Leonidas, and right after him immediately conceived Cleombrotus, though some say that Cleombrotus and Leonidas were twins. The woman who bore Cleomenes, the second wife who had come to him, was the daughter of Prinetata's son of Demarmenus, and she did not bear a second child. Now Cleomenes, as is said, was not sound of mind, in fact quite mad, whereas Dorius was first among all his peers in age, and he was well aware that he himself would hold the kingship by his own merit. Being of this mind then, when Anaxandrides died and the Lacedaemonians, following their custom, established the eldest, Cleomenes, as king, Dorius, taking this hard and not thinking it right to be ruled by Cleomenes, asked for a body of people and led them out as a colony, without consulting the oracle at Delphi as to what land he should go found, and without doing any of the customary things. Bearing this heavily, he sent his ships off to Libya, and men of Thera guided him there. On arriving in Libya, he settled the finest region of the Libyans, beside the river Sinops. But driven out from there in the third year by the Maci, a Libyan people, and by the Carthaginians, he came to the Peloponnese. Their Antichares, a man of Ilion, advised him, on the basis of the oracles of Laius, to found Heraclea in Sicily, saying that the whole territory of Eryx belonged to the Heraclidae, since Heracles himself had acquired it. On hearing this, he went to Delphi to consult the oracle, whether he would take the land to which he was setting out, and the Pythia declared that he would take it. So Dorius took up the same expedition he had led to Libya and sailed along the coast of Italy. At that time, as the people of Sybaris say, they themselves together with Teles their king were about to march against Croton, and the Crotonians, becoming very afraid, begged Dorius to help them and got what they asked. Dorius, they say, joined the campaign against Sybaris and helped to take it. This is what the Sybarites say Dorius and his men did, but the Crotonians say that no foreigner joined their side in the war against Sybaris except Callias the Iamid, a seer from Elis, and him alone, and even him in the following way. He had fled to them from Teles, tyrant of the Sybarites, because when he sacrificed against Croton, the omens did not turn out favorable. This is what these people say. Each side offers proof of its claims. The Sybarites point to a sacred precinct and temple beside the dry Crathais, which they say Dorius, after taking the city, established for Athena with the epithet Crathia. And this, they say, is the greatest proof, the death of Dorius himself, for they say he perished because he did what was contrary to the oracle's instructions. For if he had done nothing beside what he was sent to do, he would have taken the territory of Eryx, and having taken it, held it, and neither he nor his army would have perished. The Crotonians, for their part, point out that Callias of Elis was given choice lands in Crotoniate territory, much of it, which even down to my time Callias' descendants still hold, while Dorius and his descendants got nothing. Yet if Dorius had actually taken part in the Sybarite War, far more would have been given to him than to Callias. These, then, are the proofs each side puts forward, and anyone may side with whichever party he finds convincing. Other Spartans also sailed with Dorius as fellow founders, Thessalus, Periabates, Selles, and Eurylon, and when they arrived in Sicily with the whole expedition, they were defeated in battle and killed by the Phoenicians and the people of Egesta. Of the fellow founders, only Eurylon survived this disaster. Gathering together the survivors of the army, he took Minoa, the colony of the Selinuncians, and helped free the Selinuncians from their sole ruler Pythagoras. And afterward, once he had put an end to him, he himself attempted to seize the tyranny of Selinus and ruled alone for a short time. For the Selinuncians rose up against him and killed him as he had taken refuge at the altar of Zeus of the marketplace. Dorius was accompanied and died together with Philip son of Butisides, a man of Croton, who had become betrothed to the daughter of Teles the Sybarite and fled Croton. But cheated of the marriage, he sailed off to Cyrene, and setting out from there, he had joined the expedition with his own trireme and his own crew paid at his own expense, being an Olympic victor and the handsomest of the Greeks of his time. Because of his beauty, he received from the people of Egesta an honor no one else received. They built a shrine over his tomb and propitiate him with sacrifices. Dorius, then, met his end in this way. But if he had put up with being ruled by Cleomenes and had stayed in Sparta, he would have become king of Laestemon. For Cleomenes did not rule for very long, but died without a son, leaving only a daughter whose name was Gorgo. Aristagoras, the tyrant of Miletus, arrived at Sparta while Cleomenes still held power. And he came before him for a conversation, as the Lacedaemonians say, carrying a bronze tablet on which was engraved a map of the whole earth, with every sea and every river marked. Coming before him for the conversation, Aristagoras spoke to him as follows. Cleomenes, do not be surprised at my eagerness in coming here, for the matter at hand is this. It is a disgrace and the greatest source of grief that the sons of the Ionians are slaves rather than free, grief for us most of all, but also, beyond that, for you, insofar as you stand at the head of Greece. Now then, in the name of the gods of the Greeks, rescue the Ionians, men of your own blood, from slavery. This is a thing easy for you to accomplish, for the barbarians are not valiant in war, while you have brought your skill in warfare to the highest pitch of excellence, and their manner of fighting is this, bow and short spear. Into battle they go clad in trousers, with felt caps on their heads, so they are easy to conquer. Moreover, the people who inhabit that continent possess good things such as no other peoples together possess, beginning with gold, and then silver and bronze and embroidered clothing and pack animals and slaves. All these you could have for yourselves if you wished. They are settled next to one another as I shall show you, Here, next to these Ionians, are the Lydians, who inhabit a good land and are very rich in silver. As he said this, he pointed to the world map that he had brought along, engraved on the tablet. Next to the Lydians, Aristagoras went on, come the Phrygians here to the east, who have more flocks than any people I know, along with crops richer than anyone else's. Bordering the Phrygians are the Cappadocians, whom we call Syrians. Bordering these are the Cilicians, reaching down to this sea here, in which lies this island of Cyprus. They pay the king 500 talents as their yearly tribute. Next to these Cilicians come these Armenians here, who likewise have many flocks, and next to the Armenians the Mashani, who hold this land here. Next to these comes this land, Sicia, in which, beside this river here, the Chosps, lies Susa itself, the place where the great king keeps his court, and where the treasuries of his wealth, that is where they live. Once you have taken this city, you can confidently vie with Zeus himself for wealth. But is it really necessary that, for the sake of a small and not very good stretch of land, and narrow borders, you should keep putting off battles against the Messenians, who are your equals in strength, and against the Arcadians and Argives, none of whom have anything to do with gold or silver, for which some men are driven by eagerness to die fighting? When it is open to you to rule all of Asia with ease, will you choose something else instead? So spoke Aristagoras, and Cleomenes answered him thus, my Milesian guest friend, I put off my answer to you until the third day. At that point, they took the matter that far. But when the appointed day for the answer came, and they met at the agreed place, Cleomenes asked Aristagoras how many days long the road ran from the Ionian coast up to the king. Now Aristagoras, clever as he was in other respects and skilled at deceiving that man, slipped up here. For since he wanted to lead the Spartiates out into Asia, he ought not to have told the truth, but he did tell it, saying that the journey inland was 3 months. Cleomenes seized on the rest of what Aristagoras was setting out to say about the road, and said, my Milesian guest friend, be gone from Sparta before the sun sets. You are proposing nothing agreeable to the Lacedaemonians, wanting to lead them a 3 months' journey from the sea. Having said this, Cleomenes went off to his house, and Aristagoras took an olive branch as a suppliant and went to Cleomenes' house. Entering as a suppliant, he asked to be heard, and asked Cleomenes to send away the child, for Cleomenes' daughter was standing beside him, whose name was Gorgo. She happened to be his only child, about 8 or 9 years old. Cleomenes told him to say what he wanted and not to hold back on the child's account. Then Aristagoras began by promising 10 talents if Cleomenes would grant what he asked. When Cleomenes refused, Aristagoras kept raising the sum until he had promised 50 talents, at which point the child cried out, father, this stranger will corrupt you if you don't get up and leave. Cleomenes, pleased at the child's advice, went into another room, and Aristagoras left Sparta altogether, and had no further opportunity to explain anything more about the journey up to the king. The matter of this road stands as follows. Everywhere along it there are royal way stations and excellent lodgings, and the whole road runs through inhabited and safe country. Through Lydia and Phrygia there are 20 stations, and 94.5 parasangs. Next after Phrygia comes the river Halys, at which there are gates that one must absolutely pass through, and so cross the river, and there is a great garrison post there. Having crossed into Cappadocia and traveling through it as far as the borders of Cilicia, there are 28 stations and 104 parasangs. On these borders you will pass through 2 sets of gates and past 2 garrison posts. Once past these and making one's way through Cilicia, there are 3 stations and 15.5 parasangs. The border of Cilicia and Armenia is a navigable river named the Euphrates. In Armenia there are 15 stations with lodgings and 56.5 parasangs, with a garrison post among them. From this Armenia, crossing into the land of Mashan, there are 34 stations and 137 parasangs. 4 navigable rivers flow through this land, which one must absolutely cross by ferry, the Tigris first of all, and after it 2 more, a second and a third, each bearing that same name, yet not the same river as one another nor fed from the same source. The first of these mentioned flows from Armenia, and the second later one from the Mashani. The 4th of the rivers is called the Ginz, which Cyrus once split into 360 channels. Crossing from this land into the Sician country, there are 11 stations and 42.5 parasangs as far as the river Chosps, which is likewise navigable, On it stands the city of Susa. These stations altogether number 111. Such is the count of lodging stations for one traveling inland from Sardis up to Susa. Now supposing the royal road has been correctly measured in parasangs, and a parasang is worth 30 stads, as indeed it is, then from Sardis to the palace called Memnonion the distance is 13,500 stads, the parasangs being 450. Traveling 150 stads each day, the journey uses up exactly 90 days. So when the Milesian Aristagoras told Cleomenes the Lacedaemonian that the journey up to the king was 3 months, he spoke correctly. But if anyone wants a more precise figure still, I will give that too. For one must add to this the road from Ephesus to Sardis. And I say that the total number of stads from the Greek sea to Susa, for that is what the city of Memnon is called, is 14,040. For from Ephesus to Sardis, it is 540 stads, and so the three-month journey is lengthened by 3 days. Having been driven out of Sparta, Aristagoras went to Athens, which had become free of its tyrants in the following way. After Hipparchus, son of Pisistratus and brother of the tyrant Hippias, had seen in a dream a vision that most vividly foretold his own fate, and was then killed by Aristogiton and Harmodius, men of Jephyrian stock by origin, the Athenians were ruled as tyrants for 4 more years no less harshly, but even more so than before. Now this was Hipparchus's dream. On the night before the Panathenaea, Hipparchus dreamed that a tall and handsome man stood over him and spoke these riddling verses. Endure, lion, enduring the unendurable with an enduring heart. No man who does wrong will go unpunished. As soon as day came, he openly consulted dream interpreters about this. Then, dismissing the vision, he sent out the procession, in which he met his death. As for the Jephyrians, to whom the killers of Hipparchus belonged, by their own account they originally came from Eretria, but as I find by inquiry, they were Phoenicians, among those who came with Cadmus to the land now called Boeotia, and they settled in the portion of that land allotted to them, the Tanagrian district. From there, the Argives first drove out the Cadmeans, and afterward the Boeotians in turn expelled these Jephyrians and turned toward Athens. The Athenians received them as citizens of their own on stated terms, imposing on them restrictions of many kinds not worth recounting. These Phoenicians who came with Cadmus, of whom the Jephyrians were part, after settling in this land, introduced among the Greeks a number of skills, and in particular writing, which the Greeks did not have before, as it seems to me, at first using the letters that all Phoenicians use. But as time passed, together with their language, they also changed the form of the letters. At that time, the Greeks who lived around them in most of these regions were Ionians, who learned the letters through instruction from the Phoenicians and adopted them, changing their form slightly, and in using them called them, as was only right since the Phoenicians had brought them into Greece, Phoenician letters. And the Ionians from ancient times call books skins, because once, in a scarcity of papyrus, they used the skins of goats and sheep. And even in my own time, many foreign peoples still write on such skins. I myself have also seen Cadmean letters at Thebes in Boeotia, inside the shrine of Apollo of Ismenes, engraved on certain tripods, mostly similar to the Ionic letters. One of the tripods bears the inscription, Amphitryon dedicated me from the spoils of the Telebo. This would date to about the time of Laius, son of Labdacus, son of Polydorus, son of Cadmus. Another tripod says, in hexameter verse, Scius the boxer, having one, dedicated me to far-shooting Apollo, a very beautiful offering. This Scius would be the son of Hippocoon, if indeed it is he who made the dedication and not someone else bearing the same name as the son of Hippocoon, dating to about the time of Oedipus, son of Laius. A third tripod also says, in hexameter, Laodamas, while sole ruler, himself dedicated this tripod to keen-sighted Apollo, a very beautiful offering. It was in the time of this Laodamas, son of Ediocles, as sole ruler, that the Cadmeans were driven out by the Argives and turned toward the Encheles. The Jephyrians, who were left behind, were later driven out by the Boeotians and withdrew to Athens, and they have shrines established at Athens in which the rest of the Athenians have no share, being set apart from the other rites, among them in particular the shrine and mysteries of Achaean Demeter. So much then for the account of Hipparchus's dream and of where the Jephyrians came from, to whom the killers of Hipparchus belonged. Now, I must go back and take up again the story I set out to tell at the start, of how the Athenians were freed from their tyrants. While Hippias was ruling as tyrant and growing embittered against the Athenians because of Hipparchus's death, the Alcmaeonids, who were Athenians by birth and were in exile from the Pisistratids, when their attempt along with the other Athenian exiles to force their return by strength, did not succeed, but met with great disaster in their attempt to return and free Athens, after fortifying Lepsidrium above Paeonia. Then the Alcmaeonids, contriving every possible scheme against the Pisistratids, took a contract from the Amphictyons to build the temple at Delphi, the one now standing but which did not yet exist then. Being well supplied with money and men of repute from of old, they built the temple more beautiful than the design called for in other among other things. Although they had contracted to build the temple of porous stone, they had its front finished in Parian marble instead. Now the Athenians say that these men, once established at Delphi, bribed the Pythia with money so that whenever Spartans came to consult the oracle, whether on a private errand or on public business, she would put before them the charge to free Athens. The Lacedaemonians, since the same prophecy kept coming to them again and again, sent Anchimolius, son of Astor, a man of good standing among the citizens, to drive the Pisistratids out of Athens with an army, even though the Pisistratids were their closest guest friends, for they held the gods' business to be of greater weight than the affairs of men. They sent these men by sea in ships. Anchimolius put in at Phalerum and disembarked his army there, but the Pisistratids, forewarned of this, sent to Thessaly for aid, for an alliance had been made between them. The Thessalians, at their request, by common decision sent 1,000 horsemen and their own king, Sinias, a man of Canaan. When the Pisistratids had these allies, they devised the following plan. Having cleared the plain of Phalerum and made that ground fit for cavalry, they let the horse loose upon the enemy camp. Falling upon it, the cavalry destroyed many others of the Lacedaemonians, and Anchimolius among them. Those of them who survived they penned up in their ships. So the first expedition from Laestamon ended in this way, and Anchimolius' grave is in Attica at Alopki, near the Heracleum in Sinisarges. After this, the Lacedaemonians sent out a larger expedition against Athens, appointing King Cleomenes, son of Anaxandrides, as commander of the army, no longer sending it by sea but by land. When they invaded Attic territory, the Thessalian cavalry was the first to meet them, and before long it was routed, and more than 40 of their men fell. The survivors made off at once, just as they were, straight for Thessaly. Cleomenes reached the city with the Athenians who favored liberty at his side, and there he laid siege to the tyrants, who were shut up within the Pelasgian wall. And the Lacedaemonians would certainly not have driven out the Pisistratids at all, for they had no intention of making a blockade, and the Pisistratids were well supplied with food and drink, and after besieging them for a few days, the Lacedaemonians would have gone back to Sparta. But as it happened, chance turned out badly for the one side, and, as it happened, was an ally for the other. For the children of the Pisistratids, being smuggled out of the country, were captured. When this happened, all their affairs were thrown into confusion, and they surrendered their children back on terms the Athenians wished, so as to leave Attica within 5 days. After this, they withdrew to Sigeum on the Scamander, having ruled the Athenians for 36 years, and being themselves originally of Pylos and of the line of Neleus, descended from the same stock as those around Codrus and Melanthus, who, though originally immigrants, became kings of the Athenians. In memory of this, Hippocrates gave his son the same name, calling him Pisistratus after Pisistratus, the son of Nestor. In this way, the Athenians were rid of their tyrants. But before I tell of the notable things they did or suffered once freed, before Ionia revolted from Darius and Aristagoras of Miletus came to Athens to ask for their help, I will first relate this. Athens, though great even before, once rid of her tyrants became still greater. In her two men held power. Cleisthenes, a man of the Alcmaeonid family, who is said to have persuaded the Pythia, and Isagoras, son of Tisander, of a distinguished household, though of his more distant origins I cannot speak, his kinsmen sacrificed to Zeus of Caria. These men contended for power, and Cleisthenes, being worsted, took the people into partnership with him. Then he changed the Athenians, who had been organized into 4 tribes, into 10, doing away with the names taken from the sons of Ion, Jellion, Egicors, Argades, and Hopples, and finding instead the names of other local heroes, except for Ajax, him being a neighbor and ally, though a foreigner, he added. In this, it seems to me, this Cleisthenes was imitating his own mother's father, Cleisthenes the tyrant of Sicyon. For Cleisthenes of Sicyon, when at war with the Argives, first stopped the rhapsodes in Sicyon from competing in recitations of Homer's verses, because the Argives and Argus are celebrated in them throughout. And second, since there was, and still is, in the very marketplace of the Sicyonians a shrine of Adrastus, son of Talaus, Cleisthenes wished to expel him, an Argive, from the land. Going to Delphi, he asked the oracle whether he should expel Adrastus, and the Pythia answered him saying that Adrastus was king of the Sicyonians, but he himself was a stone thrower. Since the god would not grant this, he went back and thought of a device by which Adrastus himself would depart. When he thought he had found one, he sent to Thebes in Boeotia, saying he wished to bring in Melanippus, son of Astacus, and the Thebans gave him leave. Bringing in Melanippus, Cleisthenes assigned him a precinct within the very town hall, setting him up there in its most secure spot. Cleisthenes brought in Melanippus, for this too must be told, because he was the bitterest enemy of Adrastus, since he had killed both Adrastus' brother Mecistius and his son-in-law Tydeus. Once he had assigned him the precinct, he took away the sacrifices and festivals from Adrastus and gave them to Melanippus. Now the Sicyonians had been accustomed to honor Adrastus very greatly, for the land had been Polybus, and Adrastus was the son of Polybus' daughter, and Polybus, dying childless, gave the rule to Adrastus. So among other honors the Sicyonians paid to Adrastus, they especially honored his sufferings with tragic choruses, honoring not Dionysus but Adrastus. Cleisthenes gave the choruses back to Dionysus and the rest of the worship to Melanippus. This is what he did concerning Adrastus. As for the tribes of the Dorians, so that they should not be the same for the Sicyonians as for the Argives, he changed them to other names. There too he made the greatest mockery of the Sicyonians, for he named the tribes after a pig and a donkey, only changing the endings, except for his own tribe. That one he named after his own rule. These were called the Archelaei, others the Hyetae, others the Oneti, and others the Choeridae. The Sicyonians used these names of the tribes both during Cleisthenes' rule and for 60 years after his death. But afterward, taking counsel together, they changed them to the Hylaes, the Pamphylae, and the Daimonati, and added a fourth to these, named after Aegialius, son of Adrastus, calling it the Aegiales. This is what Cleisthenes of Sicyon had done. But the Athenian Cleisthenes, being the grandson of this man of Sicyon through his mother and bearing the same name after him, it seems to me that he too, looking down on the Ionians so that his people's tribes would not match those of the Ionians, imitated his namesake. For once he had won over the Athenian people, who had before been rejected, entirely to his own side, he renamed the tribes and made them more numerous than before out of fewer. He made 10 tribe leaders instead of 4, and likewise distributed the deems among the tribes in groups of 10. And having won the people over, he was far superior to his rivals. Isagoras, getting the worst of it in his turn, devised the following countermove. He called in Cleomenes the Lacedaemonian, who had become his guest friend since the siege of the Pisistratids, and Cleomenes was accused of visiting Isagoras' wife. At first Cleomenes dispatched a herald to Athens who called for Cleisthenes to be cast out, and along with him a great number of other Athenians, whom he named as men under the curse. He sent this message on the instructions of Isagoras. For the Alcmaeonids and their partisans bore the guilt for that killing, while Isagoras himself had no part in it, nor did his friends. The accursed men of the Athenians got their name in this way. There was Cylon, an Athenian and an Olympic victor. He aimed at tyranny, and gathering a company of men his own age, he attempted to seize the Acropolis, but failing to gain control of it, he sat as a suppliant at the statue of the goddess. The presidents of the Nocrares, who then governed Athens, made them rise on the promise of safety short of death. But the killing of them is charged to the Alcmaeonids. This happened before the time of Pisistratus. When Cleomenes sent to demand the expulsion of Cleisthenes and the accursed, Cleisthenes himself withdrew quietly, but Cleomenes nonetheless came to Athens, not with a large force, and on arriving, he drove out as accursed 700 Athenian households, which Isagoras had suggested to him. Having done this, he next attempted to dissolve the council, putting the offices into the hands of 300 partisans of Isagoras. But when the council resisted and refused to obey, Cleomenes and Isagoras and his partisans seized the Acropolis. The rest of the Athenians, of one mind, laid siege to them for 2 days. On the third day, those of them who were Lacedaemonians left the country under truce. And the prophecy was fulfilled for Cleomenes. For when he went up to the Acropolis, intending to take possession of it, he went into the inner sanctuary of the goddess as if to address her. But before he could pass through the doors, the priestess rose from her seat and said, "Stranger of Lacedaemon, turn back and stay out of the shrine, for Dorians are not permitted to enter it." He said, "But woman, I am not a Dorian, but an Achaean." Paying no heed at all to the omen, he made his attempt, and was then again driven out along with the Lacedaemonians. But the rest the Athenians bound and held for execution, among them Timesithius the Delphian, whose feats of hand and daring I could relate at great length. These men, then, being bound, met their end. After this the Athenians, Cleisthenes and the 700 households, driven out by Cleomenes having been sent for and recalled, sent messengers to Sardis, wishing to make common cause with the Persians, since they knew that war had broken out between the Lacedaemonians and Cleomenes on one side and themselves on the other. When the messengers arrived at Sardis and said what they had been instructed to say, Artaphernes, son of Hystaspes, governor of Sardis, asked who these people were and where in the world they lived, that they wanted to become allies of the Persians. And having learned this, the sum of what the messengers said on his behalf was this: if the Athenians gave King Darius earth and water, he would make an alliance with them, but if they did not, they were to leave. The messengers, taking it upon themselves, said they would give it, since they wanted the alliance to be made. On returning home, they came under grave blame for this. Cleomenes, meanwhile, understanding that he had been badly insulted in word and deed by the Athenians, gathered an army from the whole Peloponnese, without saying against whom he was gathering it, wanting both to punish the Athenian people and to set up Isagoras as tyrant, for Isagoras had come out with him from the Acropolis. So Cleomenes invaded Eleusis with a great force, and the Boeotians, by prearrangement, seized Ono and Hysiae, the outlying villages of Attica, while the Chalcidians, for their part, came in and ravaged parts of Attica. The Athenians, though caught between two fronts, decided to deal with the Boeotians and Chalcidians later, and drew up their arms against the Peloponnesians who were at Eleusis. But when the armies were about to join battle, the Corinthians were the first to reconsider among themselves that they were not acting justly, and they changed their minds and withdrew. And after them Demaratus, son of Ariston, who was likewise a king of the Spartans and had joined in leading out the army from Lacedaemon, though he had not before been at odds with Cleomenes. Because of this rift, Sparta established a rule barring both kings from accompanying the army together on campaign. For until then both had gone along together, and when one of them was excused from this, the other was to be left behind, and also one of the sons of Tyndarus. For before this both of them too, being invoked as helpers, had gone along. So then at Eleusis, when the rest of the allies saw that the kings of the Lacedaemonians did not agree and that the Corinthians had abandoned their post, they too went off and departed, this being the fourth time the Dorians had come against Attica, twice invading in war and twice for the good of the Athenian people. First, when they also settled Megara, this expedition may rightly be called the one under Codrus, king of the Athenians. Second and third, when they came from Sparta to expel the sons of Pisistratus, and fourth, on this occasion, when Cleomenes led the Peloponnesians in and invaded Eleusis. Thus this was the fourth time the Dorians invaded Athens. When this expedition broke up ingloriously, the Athenians, wanting to take revenge, first made a campaign against the Chalcidians. The Boeotians came to help the Chalcidians at the Euripus. Seeing the Boeotians, the Athenians decided to attack the Boeotians before the Chalcidians. They joined battle with the Boeotians and won decisively, killing very many and taking 700 of them alive. On this very same day, the Athenians crossed over to Euboea and engaged the Chalcidians too, and having defeated them as well, they left 4,000 settlers on the land of the Hippopotami. The Hippobotii were what the wealthy men of the Chalcidians were called. As many of these as they took alive, they kept in custody, bound in fetters along with the Boeotian captives. But in time, they released them, setting a ransom of 2 mina each. The fetters in which they once were shackled they set hanging upon the Acropolis, and the fetters still survived into my own time, hanging from the walls scorched by fire at the hands of the Mede, opposite the chamber that faces west. And they dedicated a tenth of the ransom money, making of it a bronze four-horse chariot. It stands on the left hand as one first enters the Propylaea on the Acropolis, and on it is inscribed this: "Having subdued the peoples of the Boeotians and Chalcidians, the sons of the Athenians quenched their insolence in deeds of war, with chains of iron and darkness. From the ransom they set up these horses, a tenth part, for Pallas. So the Athenians grew in power." And it is clear, not in this one instance alone, but everywhere, that equality of speech is a serious matter, if indeed the Athenians, while ruled by tyrants, were no better in war than any of their neighbors, but once freed of tyrants became by far the foremost. This shows that while held down they were deliberately slack, working as for a master, but once liberated each man was eager to achieve for himself. So this is what the Athenians were doing. The Thebans, meanwhile, afterward sent to the god, wanting to take revenge on the Athenians. The Pythia said there was no vengeance to be had from their own resources, but told them to bring the matter before the assembly of many voices and to ask help of those nearest them. When the envoys had left, they laid the oracle before an assembly. As they heard those present say to ask those nearest, the Thebans, on hearing this, said, "Do not the Tanagrians and Coronians and Thespians live nearest us? And these indeed always fight alongside us and eagerly share the burden of war with us. What need is there to ask them? Rather, perhaps this is not what the oracle means." As they were pondering such things, someone who had understood said, "I think I grasp what the oracle wants to tell us. Asopus is said to have had daughters, Tebe and Aegina. Since these are sisters, I think the god means that we should ask the Aeginetans to become our avengers." And since no better opinion appeared than this, they sent at once and asked the Aeginetans, calling on them by the oracle to help them, as being their nearest kin. They, when asked for aid, said they would send along the Aeacidae with them.